The Urban Broadcast Collective
brings together the best podcasts
on cities
and urban life.
Subscribe to us on SoundCloud
and Apple Podcasts.
This podcast is supported by VEPLA, Victorian Planning Environmental Law Association. Welcome to the Planning Exchange, where we interview built environment professionals who are doing interesting work beyond the ordinary. I'm Jess Noonan, and I'm joined by my colleague, Peter Jewell.
Are you a built environment professional who is stuck in the grind, trying to avoid burnout? Well, today's guest, Liz Makavikius, is here to help. Liz was a town planner who worked across local government and the private sector before starting Centia Consulting. Liz now helps people like you figure out how to overcome the things which are standing in the way, because it can be done. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, Liz, as I mentioned, you were previously a town planner. How did this lead you into professional coaching? Perhaps while you talk to that, you can also provide a bit of an overview of your career to date.
Yeah, sure. I mean, at first glance, they don't sound necessarily that similar, but coaching is about helping people organise their thoughts, come to logical conclusions about what they're capable of. And as an urban planner, a lot of what I did was around organising concepts, creating logical kind of pathways for policy development. So in my mind, they're actually quite similar. And I also do a bit of facilitation and training, which is, again, organizing thoughts and ideas into logical, structured ways so people can make clear and confident decisions in groups.
Was there also a moment where you were questioning your own career path, which I guess sort of led you into this?
Yeah, there was. I worked for nearly 20 years in state and local government, as well as consulting, and I wanted a new challenge. And I mean, I'm sure we'll kind of get to this a bit later on, but it was kind of a bit of a post-COVID thing. So, you know, we're COVID, we all promised ourselves we were going to do things differently. And then I sort of got to the point where I'm like, I want to do something different. So in the consulting role that I had, I had a number of roles there, executive roles as well. So kind of corporate, thinking about team performance and development. So that's kind of how I came across coaching as a whole profession, I suppose. So that's kind of what triggered it, is that I started helping people work through that kind of stuff and then realized that there was actually a career pathway in it. And now I don't do a lot of work as a planner, but I certainly still care quite deeply about cities and places and communities. And this is now how I help through that, is helping planners and people in the built environment organize their thoughts so they can make clear and confident decisions.
Mm. Liz, I might have to book you for a daily session as a coaching.
But, I'm a psychologist, Pete.
Now, Liz, I'm broken planner, I am, Jess. But Liz, who are your clients and what sort of backgrounds do they have?
My clients are a whole range of different sorts of people. I have quite a number of people who want to get better at what they do, whether that's in leadership roles or their effectiveness in the day-to-day work. They want to be more effective and do better work. So they kind of, you know, coaching can help people understand where their challenges are, what their strengths are, how to use those strengths, how to overcome the barriers that stand in their way. And I do also work with quite a lot of people at the moment who are figuring out what's next. So people who are kind of at a point in their career where they're like, I love what I do, but yeah, as you said, maybe a little bit tired or burnt out and kind of thinking about what's next. So I help people like that figure out their pathway. It's across government and the private sector, early career to more established people. And I think one thing that's important, there can be a bit of a myth that coaching, it's often called executive coaching, and there's this kind of idea that it's for executives, but really coaching is something that can help people at any stage of their career.
And Liz, anecdotally, and I think we can probably all attest to this, that the built environment industry more broadly, particularly those in government, can be quite prone to frustration and exhaustion, and we're seeing lots of people leaving the industry, pursuing career changes, or even, you know, quite simply just going off on stress leave and those sorts of things. Are you seeing this across the board, and is it specific to the built environment industry?
I don't think it's specific to the built environment. I mean, I do think that that's pretty challenging sector at the moment, just in terms of like government uncertainty around a number of projects. It's a particularly challenging time. So I do think built environment is probably bearing the brunt of that, but I also don't think it's just that sector. I think it's happening a lot. I kind of mentioned before the post-COVID thing. I think there are a lot of people out there who are kind of, we've snapped back and we're kind of doing the same things and we're all busy and everyone, and some people are like, we thought we were going to do things differently. So I do think there's lots of people out there who are kind of thinking about that and wondering whether there's a better way to live, essentially, and how work kind of fits into that. So, yeah, you know, coaching can help people get real clarity on what they want and the confidence to get it. So I think that visualizing that goal and really getting clear on what that life looks like that has rewarding work built into it can be really helpful and rewarding for people.
I agree. What you said before, that coaching is quite often reserved for people in executive roles, and that's certainly been my experience over the years. Do you think that, I guess, the coaching at the levels below executive will assist in, I guess, ensuring that our planners and those working in the built environment maintain the passion and enthusiasm and resilience and all those things that are required in order to deal with the big issues that we're dealing with as an industry?
I mean, I think so. I'm possibly a little bit, you know, I have a particular view on that. But yeah, I 100% think that workplaces providing the scaffolding for people to thrive in a workplace is really important. And we need to support people who are working in these super busy roles, need to give them the skills for a start, but also support them to be their best. So we're dealing with complex problems. They're really, you know, these are wicked public policy challenges in a lot of cases, and they need creative solutions. There's a lot of things that aren't that are out of our control, but there's also a lot that we do control, and we really need to focus on that. So I think, you know, we're talking about the skill shortage and how challenging it is at the moment. And I think it's really important. Like, I think mindset is a huge part of how fulfilled we are in the workplace. And I think we can all kind of work on our mindset to be more fulfilled. But I would also say that there are some perhaps somewhat ambitious expectations put on people in some instances. Like, you know, I often say to people, like, yoga and fruit bowls don't fix a toxic workplace. Like, there's only so much that you can do to sort of manage yourself in a situation.
And they're band-aid solutions, aren't they, really?
Yeah. Yeah. If there's too much work to do and not enough people, then, like, yeah, yoga and fruit bowls ain't going to fix it.
Free apples, not going to do it.
It is not.
Liz, do you do group coaching or is it one-on-one? How can you maybe just give us an example of how that would work?
Sure. So I mainly do one-on-one. So, and, you know, those sessions are confidential. They're just between me and the person I'm coaching, often in organizational context. So the organization sponsors someone. And so there's kind of a three-way conversation. So we set goals in service of the organization, and then we have the coaching sessions one-on-one, and they can go in all sorts of different directions, but they're really, you know, the purpose of it is to unpack the stories and assumptions and beliefs we have about our capabilities and maybe reframe that into more helpful ways. And it can also be around kind of pressure testing or preempting some of the challenges. We know that behavior change is hard, and if you're trying to work on something to change it, you really need to kind of think about, you know, what's going to be a challenge and what's going to get in the way. So that's the one-on-ones, as I said, can sort of go in all sorts of different directions. But I also really like group coaching because people see other people struggling with the same challenges, and you get this real sense that you're not alone in the things that you're struggling with. And I think that's part of the challenge as well. When we're all so busy, we're perhaps not connecting in the same kind of way. So group coaching can provide an accountability framework. So particularly if they're, you know, within the same organization, say you've got all of the team leaders or coordinators kind of doing some group coaching, there can be some really great accountability in that. There's a sense of camaraderie. There's that idea that, you know, we're all in this together. And as I said, like, you realize that so many other people are facing similar sorts of challenges. And you also help people problem solve their challenge as well. So it can kind of, I do really like that group coaching because I think it can be really beneficial as well. And it's, to be honest, it can also be fairly cost effective as well as a way to kind of support team members through that.
We thank Victorian Planning Reports, our very first supporter. If you want the A to Z of planning decisions in Victoria and excellent editorials, please get yourself a subscription to the VPRs. Details on our website.
This podcast is supported by our wonderful friends at One Mile Grid. One Mile Grid is a boutique consulting firm which offers traffic and transport engineering, transport planning and waste management services. You can find out more by visiting their website at www.onemilegrid.com.au.
Liz, does the line ever get blurred between professional coach, counsellor slash psychologist? Because I assume that when you're doing an individual coaching session with someone, you're sort of hearing probably a lot of their innermost fears, you know, the things that they need to work through in order to grow professionally and to build themselves up.
Yeah, definitely the line can get blurry. Coaching is not therapy. And I'm really clear on that, and I'm upfront with people. So I said before that coaching is always is confidential, but if I have mental health, if I've got concerns about mental health, then that's something that I can, that I will flag externally potentially. But yeah, it can be quite a personal thing. We do get to the heart of people's ideas about themselves. So it can be quite personal, but it's also, you're under no obligation to share anything that you don't want to. You know, I'm certainly not going to force people to talk about things they don't want to, but yeah, like a lot can come up and it can bring up all sorts of emotions. And often I find that people are saying things in a coaching session that have been floating around in their head, but they've never said them aloud before. And like when you say things aloud, your brain processes it a little bit differently to it being in your head. So just that opportunity to talk things out can often be what people need. So it's kind of, it's not a one size fits all. It can be quite personal if that's where we want to go, but by the same token, it could also, doesn't necessarily have to go there. So if you don't want to go there, then we don't have to go there by any means.
I think as well, as you say, we very rarely set aside time for ourselves to sort of think deeply about our careers and what we want to do and, you know, what our greatest fears are, and I guess how those sorts of things can actually impact our daily lives and our professional lives. So, yeah, it's a really good opportunity, I think, through that coaching process to do that. So totally agree.
And I guess the other thing I'd add is that coaching is not advice. So I don't give advice, or sometimes I'll offer something, I will always ask permission for that. But so what people get when they come to coaching is different from mentoring, is different from sponsorship, because I have no vested interest in any particular outcome. So I guess that's, you know, and I think we all need to have like a network of people around us in a professional and personal context to bounce ideas off and to kind of, you know, help us think through things. But one of the benefits of coaching is that, yeah, it doesn't bother me which way you kind of decide to go in the end. I don't have an interest in you taking a particular course of action. So
yeah, of course,
independence can often be something that people might struggle to find elsewhere, I suppose.
Yeah. And fundamentally, Liz, many planners enter this built environment industry hoping to create change. They become frustrated, discouraged by the political environment in particular, which generally prevails above good outcomes. You've previously discussed the concept of motivation frameworks. Would you mind elaborating on what these are and how they would apply to planners?
Yeah, sure. And I have talked about it, but it's certainly not my framework. It's a guy called Daniel Pink wrote a book about all this sort of stuff. So I would definitely encourage listeners to seek that out if you're interested. But it's basically this idea that there are three kind of elements. Well, I think there are three elements to fulfilling work. And one of those is around mastery. So getting better at things, building our skills and expressing our capabilities. The second one is autonomy. So having some say over how and where and when we work and the nature of the work that we do. And the third one is purpose. So what are we trying to achieve through our work? So there's those three elements in mastery, autonomy, and purpose. And I think that to be fulfilled at work, we need to think about how each of those are expressed for us individually. And I think the challenge for planners is that often we're there for the purpose because we care about places and we want to make places and communities better. We want to have this positive impact on the world, which is wonderful and I love that. But if you only have purpose and you haven't thought about what are the skills that you're trying to master, what are the things that you're really good at and how do you like make sure that you're using your strengths every day and getting better at those things? And also, how do you like to work and who do you want to work with and how does all that work? If you're missing those other two parts, that mastery and autonomy part, and you're just constantly driven by purpose, I think that's a recipe for burnout because you can never kind of get there. We can never solve all of the problems. So you're always trying to kind of do more. And so I think, you know, that purpose is like, it's, you know, it's a balance, right? Like purpose is a wonderful thing and I'm totally on board and I support and love that we're all, you know, working to make places and communities better. But if that's the only way that we're thinking about the success or otherwise of our work, then yeah, it can definitely lead to burnout.
I think, Liz, some of the objectives you mentioned are very tough to achieve in, say, a council, local government area, or even state government, because the planning process is very complex and there's tons and tons and tons of procedural things. If it was just about, you know, assessing decisions, assessing proposals on their merits and making decision, you know, we'd all want that. But for the time spent doing that, there's maybe 90% of the time caught up in processes that are very humdrum and numbing, and there's not a lot of autonomy in that. And, you know, if the policy says no to something, you've got no autonomy, essentially. I speak from experience, Liz, from local government work, but do you think I've been a bit down on how it is for a lot of people in planning positions in government?
Oh, it's a tricky one, Peter. Like, I wouldn't want to underestimate how challenging it can be, certainly. As you said, there's all sorts of challenges out there and, you know, workloads are through the roof and people are trying to do too much with too little. So I'm not trying to downplay that, but I do think that thinking about like how you organize yourself in a day-to-day, the boundaries that you want to establish around work into your the rest of your life, how you think about work for yourself. I think like we do have a lot of things we can control. I take your point that there's a lot that we can't, but there are lots of things that we can control. And I think it's about kind of figuring out like how we want to manage those things, how we want to structure our time, structure our day, like approach our work, what skills we want to build, maybe what areas we want to move into. Like, I think there's plenty of scope there for people to not feel terrible, I hope, to be honest.
Liz, we've spoken obviously a little bit there about purpose and that a lot of people in the built environment industry have this idea of wanting to create change and influence their environment and that sort of thing. But I'm interested, what happens when that purpose that they have is perhaps a little bit less philosophical and more about just wanting a good job that pays a decent salary, has good working conditions, you get a fruit basket, you have some yoga. Can that also be purpose, or is that not enough in the long term to maintain engagement?
Oh, I think I'm 100% about having work that fits with your life. And I think, you know, and this might change for people over the course of their life, and certainly, you know, returning to work with young children, that's not my experience, but I know for other people, like, work needs to fit in and fulfill like different roles at different times in life. So I think that, like, absolutely, a decent salary, good working conditions, I mean, that's a baseline, right? And, you know, I think that that can be enough. I do think that expressing, I've said before, like expressing our skills and kind of exploring our capabilities is, you know, that's really, that can be really rewarding. But I also totally take the point that sometimes in our lives, we have many other things going on outside of work, and we're putting our energy into that as well. So I definitely, like, I'm fully on board with the idea that work should be fulfilling, but I also think that work needs to fit with a fulfilling life. And the life part is the important part in my book.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one of the other points, or one of the other parts of the framework that you mentioned before, was mastery. Can we talk about Goldilocks tasks? So those are the tasks that are considered to be not too hard, but not too easy. Surely we should be encouraging our planners to challenge themselves so that we can address these big issues of our time. Or is it not about that?
No, I think that Goldilocks idea is a beautiful one. Like, there's, I'm going to try and pronounce his name, is Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. So he wrote a book called Flow. He's written a number of books, but this idea that, like, that flow state, you know, when, like, you forget what time it is, you're so deep into your work because you just kind of, it's all kind of happening and the words just kind of seem to come out the, you know, out of your fingers onto the keyboard, and it all works really well. Like, that really deep thinking and working, like, that's the Goldilocks. That's that middle part, you know, it's where we're challenged a little bit. We're kind of pushed a little bit, but not too much. Too much is overwhelming, but we're kind of pushed just enough to, like, challenge our capabilities in a way that is rewarding. We're solving problems. So I think that requires, like, some time, few distractions. It requires you to be able to kind of carve out the time to be able to do that. And that's obviously a challenge, you know, with busy diaries and on all that kind of stuff. So, but that's how I think we can address those big issues. Like, that's when the creative thoughts happen, and that's when we come up with our best ideas, is really in that state where we can think deeply about these challenges, and we're pushed a little bit. So yeah, I think that's exactly what we should be encouraging people to do, and providing that the scaffolding to be able to do that.
Liz, part of the issue also presumably is system design, process design, because poorly designed systems can make for low productivity and just hard work for everyone. Have you got any thoughts about that? It's a bit of a tangent, off on a tangent from where we are, but what about system design? And I often think we've got a sort of, our planning system has a first world sort of focus and complexity, but our delivery system is second or third world. And I don't mean to run down the second or third world people who are listening, but do you think there's something about looking at it in another way, a different way?
Oh, I mean, if you're asking me whether I think the planning system needs significant reform, then I would say I would 100% agree. Like, it does seem, I must say, I'm not a statutory planner. I didn't do statutory planning, but yeah, I understand enough about the system to know that there's all sorts of kind of crazy processes in there that have born out of legacy decisions, and, you know, they've, you know, this bolt-on kind of approach, you know, bits and pieces being added over time has yeah, in a lot of cases created, like, really arduous, unnecessary pathways for things. So I think that's, you know, and that's kind of part of the challenge that we face as planners, is like, how to reform that system. And I know that, you know, many efforts have been made at that. It's not an easy task because, you know, we're dealing with a really complex system, you know, our cities and places and you know, communities, you know, it's not straightforward. These are very complex systems. So it's not that it's an easy task to kind of make those processes simpler, but I do think there's a lot to be said for trying to, make those processes a bit more straightforward, so that we are spending our valuable time and brain space solving the big problems, not navigating, shuffling pieces of paper around.
And we wonder why the community hates planning.
I know, right?
Jess, that's unfair. Come on.
They find it very confusing.
I'm warmly welcome to dinner parties. Everyone's got a planning horror story. They're either developers who've been thwarted or objectors who've been, you know, crunched. So, yeah, I think we're loved amongst our communities. Sorry, Jess.
That's optimistic.
Yeah.
Liz, I wanted to talk about decision making. And obviously within this industry, we do make lots of decisions, or we make recommendations for decisions at the very least. Can you talk to the science around that process? Most people make decisions based upon their own experiences, their ideas, and their biases.
Yeah, sure. And it's actually quite a fascinating area, decision science. I didn't really know that it was a whole area, but there is a whole kind of practice around it. And it's, you know, like in a very simple way, it's about understanding the range of outcomes, what are our preferences about those outcomes, the likelihood of those outcomes, and then kind of balancing those things out to make a decision. And I guess when we reflect on it, you know, at the preferences for an outcome, like, you know, we were just talking about the community and how much they love planners, but we, you know, we live in a community where there's a whole lot of people who have very different views. And policy isn't always clear about what our preferences are for those outcomes. And, you know, they can often be in conflict with each other. And the likelihood, again, of particular outcomes happening is often quite uncertain and unclear. So I think the complexity of the system that we're dealing with means that it can be quite challenging to apply that kind of scientific practice around it. What I would say, though, is that understanding our own biases in decision making, I think, is something that we can probably all work on. I know I certainly can. And, you know, there's a handful of biases. And when we say bias, it's really like a mental shortcut that we use to make decisions. So it's a kind of, we in our minds, we go, if this, then that. And you know, we need to shortcut things. We can't kind of sit and think about every single thing we come across every day to kind of work it through. We need to have those shortcuts so that we can exist. But there are some sort of biases that exist that are probably worth us considering in a little bit more detail. So one of them is around confirmation bias. So, you know, we often look for evidence to support our viewpoint. There's another one around recency or availability bias. So that's kind of, we remember the most recent thing that happened and take that to mean that that's perhaps what happens all the time. There's also stuff around sunk cost fallacy, which is, you know, like we can persist with something even though it might not be the best outcome, but we've kind of invested so much into it already. So there's a hand, like, I think understanding our own biases and just being aware of that when we're doing planning work, I think can be really valuable for people to kind of be aware of and build their understanding of.
And how do you do that? Like, as you said, if you sort of considered all of these things, you'd probably never get anything done. So how do we balance it?
Liz, I was also going to jump in there and say we're all shaped by our experiences, and it's very hard to break those things that you mentioned, or, you know, very hard to do.
Yeah, 100%, and it makes us who we are, and it gives us, you know, there's expertise in that as well. Like our experience is, you know, we've kind of seen some of these things before, and so we can kind of overlay that. I guess to your question, Jess, like, what do you do about it? I think it's, you know, when you've got particularly big decisions to make, it's just taking a moment, maybe a few minutes, to step back and go, what kind of assumptions am I making here? Is there anything else? Like, would someone with a different set of experiences come at this differently? you know, if I was on the debating team, how would I take down my own argument? Is there any merit in that? Like, I think just a little bit of questioning, like it doesn't have to be a huge kind of exercise to go through that. But I think just kind of being aware about these are the thought patterns that we often go through. And just, yeah, maybe like, are they relevant in this context? Do we need to think a little, do we need to spend a few more minutes just kind of thinking about an alternative perspective or something different in that particular instance?
I think as well, we all bring something to the table in those sorts of settings. As you say, we've all got our own biases, but my own biases are going to be very different to yours and to Pete. So we all bring something to the table. And, you know, that collection of different views and the tension that that brings in decision-making is also a very crucial component of a democratic society. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I agree. I think like healthy debate leads to better outcomes. There's a wonderful book called Messy by Tim Harford, and he talks about how groups, when there's cognitive diversity, which is, you know, a fancy name for saying people who think differently, when they have that and people aren't necessarily particularly friendly and they are open to discussing and debating, they get better answers. So I definitely think that that diversity, and, you know, we see this in ideas around who sits around board tables. Like, it's a big thing when boards are considering that. Like, how do we bring people together that have diverse perspectives so that we can come at these challenging problems from all of these different perspectives? So I do think that we need that in society. Like, you know, we have many different people with different views. So I do think that a little bit of that tension is good, and it's about how to have respectful debates about that. That's how we get to better outcomes and how we can solve some of these complex problems.
I wish I shared your optimism, Liz and Jess. You know, I find the planning world in terms of ideas is generally fairly set, and, you know, new ideas have to come through, you know, basically have to come out of the blue somewhere. It's very rare for new ideas or discussion about new ideas to get a fair hearing. What do you think, Jess?
Oh, I totally agree. And that's sort of been a constant topic that we've had on this podcast for years, Liz. You know, how do you get new ideas into a system that is, you know, generally quite resistant to change? And yeah, it's very, people are very quick to shut you down with new ideas, I think. And that's probably been your experience, Pete.
Well, weren't we going to have a crazy ideas festival? What do you think?
It's been on the agenda for a while, that one.
Yeah,
a few people have spoken about it. I'd be up for that.
We don't get invited to many seminars, Liz, but now I was going to ask you, Liz, about, and one thing I've noticed about, you know, local government, the culture of a workplace is very dependent, particularly when dealing with, say, young graduates or people who've been out for 4 or 5 years. The role of the team leader is incredibly important, and it's a bit like, in the army, you have, you know, NCOs, non-commissioned officers, and they look after the troops directly beneath them. And if you've got good NCOs, you've got a really good squad. But a lot of young planners, it really is hit and miss if they get a good team leader. Do you follow where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, you know, we study at university and we kind of get taught like lots of the technical skills, and then, you know, it comes to putting them into practice and dealing with the day-to-day life and offices and, you know, the practical application of that. And I think that's right. Like, it's, you know, how we support like those new graduates kind of coming through to kind of harness their enthusiasm and their optimism, but also kind of give them the tools that they need to be able to succeed. And I think you've touched on something interesting around like the role of those team leaders and, you know, how we support them as well. Like, you know, they're often kind of, they're the brightest planners, and then they're kind of given this leadership role without necessarily the scaffolding and support and skills to be able to take on that. So I think, you know, it's kind of twofold. How do we support the graduates? But then how do we support those people who are leading and managing, and, you know, it's really their role to mentor these young planners. So I think, you know, that is a really important part of, like, the sustainability of the workforce as well. Like, we've seen a lot, you know, I think peer do surveys and, you know, the number of people who are leaving the profession, who are contemplating leaving the profession, is a little bit terrifying, to be honest. Like, given, you know, the complexity of the problems that we face as planners, we really need plenty of smart, enthusiastic people hanging around the profession to help us solve these challenges. So it's really important that we keep those people in the sector, I think.
There's definitely a need, I think, and we've touched on this, to provide more training for people in those leadership positions, I think, because, you know, generally what happens in a lot of workplaces and in a lot of councils is you just sort of work your way up the ranks, right? And then you get to, you know, sort of mid-level management and someone goes, okay, great, you've got 10 years experience now. Yeah, you're going to be a team leader. And, you know, quite often, it's like it or not, you're the team leader now, and you may not necessarily have an interest. You may not necessarily have the enthusiasm or the skills for it. And it's amazing how many stories I hear of people that really, really shouldn't be in that role and probably don't want to be.
Mm. Oh, I think, yeah, that transition from doing the technical, from kind of being a doer to into that leadership situation, is, it can be quite a challenging transition. I'm glad you brought it up, because I'm working on something with the Planning Institute at the moment, some skills training group and one-on-one coaching, a new program, Pathway to Lead. So we're going to be launching that fairly soon, which is going to be aimed at those people who are starting on that leadership journey, who have just kind of stepped into that, and really providing some built skills tailored to the built environment, but also opportunities for group and one-on-one coaching to really embed those skills. Because, you know, we've all been to training days where we learn all of these amazing things and come back with the best of intentions, but, you know, behavior change is hard. So we kind of get back to our desk and it slips down the list of things that we end up doing. So that's where I do think that the group and one-on-one coaching can really help embed those new behaviors and skills, and, you know, help people work through the challenges that they're inevitably going to face when they're trying to do things a bit differently and they're learning a new skill, right? So it's, you know, they've got to kind of practice somewhere. So, yeah, so we're launching that soon with PR. So keep an eye out for that if you're in Australia.
Where will people look to that for information on that, Liz?
It will be on the PR website shortly.
That's the Planning Institute of Australia.
The Planning Institute of Australia, yes. Mm. Yep. Right. There'll be something on there very soon.
We'll have something on our episode notes about that as well. Before we get into mindset, Liz, I want to, now, you know, there's all these stereotypes about snowflake young people who are not very resilient and, you know, have been compromised by being the iPhone generation and things like that. Do you think that sort of stereotype, I don't agree with that, Liz, for one moment, but I have heard it said that, you know, this younger generation is a bit weaker. Any comments on that?
I mean, is this a bit of a third rail? I think it's really interesting because I see a lot of young-ish people. I can't call myself a young person anymore. And I think about the challenges that they are facing, you know, housing affordability, the climate, the political instability. I kind of go, oh my goodness, they're trying to deal with all of that stuff. Like, no wonder they're trying to, like, just kind of shut out the world a little bit, you know? So, like, on one hand, I totally see that. But then and at the same time, I've also had these wonderful experiences working with young people who are so kind of emotionally mature, like far more than I was when I was that age. And they, you know, they talk about how they're feeling about stuff and they support each other, and so sometimes I think we're all going to be okay. I think that, you know, the kids have got it under control and we don't need to worry. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but, like, I, you know, I appreciate that the world we live in is quite a different one to certainly the one, and I'm very glad that we didn't have social media and iPhones when I was in high school, let me say that.
Yeah. I think, Liz, part of that is you know, that people get bombarded with negative news all the time. And part of the issue is that because our world is so connected, and we can see something that's happening in a province in Brazil, or we can see something that's happening, you know, up in the north of India instantly, or a bridge that collapses or something like that. Whereas in the old days, we never had that. And also there's a great torrent of bad news that is, you know, I think is being actively promoted. So no wonder young people feel a bit glum sometimes.
Yeah, agree. And I think we all feel a bit glum sometimes. It's not just young people, but I think, you know, I also do think, like, you know, social media can get a bit of a bad rap sometimes. Like, I do a lot of trail running. The trail running community, like, I've definitely met people, like, started following them online and ended up meeting them. And I don't think that would have happened without social media. So I do think, excuse me, there's also, it can also be harnessed for good. And certainly people in kind of diverse communities, like connecting with other people on the other side of the world and feeling kind of part of that community can also be quite wonderful. So yeah, look, as I said, I'm glad there were no iPhones when I was in high school, but yeah.
It's probably a good segue, Liz, into talking about mindset and what influences it, and is it difficult to shift once it's set in?
I mean, so mindset is the stories that we tell ourselves and the beliefs and assumptions that we have about ourselves. I don't think it has to be hard to shift, but you have to want to change. You have to want to, like, be telling yourself a different story. And I think that's actually a lot of the work, is telling yourself this better story about yourself and what you're capable of. There are very few people in the world who wake up and are 100% confident about everything every day. And, like, they're like sociopaths, I think we call them. So nobody's confident all the time. So you have to, like, you do have to do the work to kind of tell yourself this better story about what you're capable of, and kind of stop waiting for it to happen and go out and get it a little bit. So,
and Liz, some of us suffer imposter syndrome as well.
Mm. So I heard someone was talking to someone about imposter syndrome the other day, and I heard this really, like, beautiful way of thinking about it is, if you are suffering from imposter syndrome, like, sometimes what you need to do is lean on other people's faith in you. So you might not have the capability, you might not have the belief that you're capable of doing this thing, but there are all of these other people out there who do think you are capable of doing this thing. So who are you to judge their judgment of you, if you know what I mean? So sometimes you've got to lean on other people, and if they think you can do it, I say go for it.
Thanks for the support from Ratio Consultants, an independent voice and trusted partner in planning, urban design, transport and waste management. Ratio supports change through projects that shape cities, neighbourhoods and places for people. See ratio.com.au for details.
And Liz, you alluded to this before, but when I look at your website, I instantly get a very clear picture of a very highly motivated athlete in your trail running and so forth. What role do you think exercise or any other extracurricular activities outside of work can play within this idea of motivation and positive mindset?
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, like, you know, for me, it's about how work fits into the life that I want to lead. And part of that is certainly spending time outside in the mountains, on trails, doing all sorts of fun stuff. So I think the way that it's helped me has been, it's shown me that I could do things that I didn't think I was capable of. And the way that I got there was incrementally, basically. Like, I just kept plugging away at running and kind of doing a little bit more and then challenging myself a little bit more. And all of a sudden I was doing 100K races through the high country, which is not something
100Ks. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's next level athlete.
So yeah, there's a beautiful race up at Mount Buller. It's a fundraiser for families with kids who have autism. And so it's called Oscar's Hut to Hut. So we go up every year and February, and it's a big race, and I've done that a couple of times. So it's also a beautiful community of kind of weirdos. We're all a bit weird. I'm sure they won't. Oh, I hope they're not offended by me saying that. But I think it's that, you know, it's that kind of finding the people that like doing what you like doing as well. So in terms of mindset, like I started out like, you know, doing 5 and 10K runs. And then I was hanging out with people who were talking about these 150 and 100K races. And I'm like, oh my goodness, well, they just look like normal humans. They don't look superhuman to me. And so when you hang around with people who are kind of doing those amazing things, you start to think that, you know, maybe you could as well. So I think
here I was thinking the 5 kilometer fun run at Easter time up Mount Buller was difficult.
Well, it is.
I feel inferior now.
Let's not underestimate that. Absolutely not. Like I started and I've just spent a lot of time doing it. So consistency will get you a long way in that. So
how many years have you been doing it?
I've been trail running now for about 7 years.
Amazing.
And kind of distance running for 8 or 9 years. So
there's still hope for you yet, Pete.
Well, Jess, I'm going to ask you about how your tennis is going, but I'll come back to you on that, Jess. But Liz, we've come to Podcast Extra or Culture Corner. Something you've read, seen, watched, listened to, experienced lately. It could be trail running. You've described that beautifully. Something that might be of interest to our listeners.
So while I was lucky enough to go overseas last year, and while I was away, I came across and read this book called The Geography of Bliss by a guy called Eric Weiner. And I think it will appeal to your listeners because it is about geography and place. And it's sort of about like what makes cultures happy. So not individuals necessarily, but like kind of what makes cultures thrive and what makes people happy. So he kind of, he travels around. I mean, he has a wonderful job. And he, you know, he visits like Iceland and looks at their attitude to creativity. And like basically in Iceland, people just have a go at stuff. And so they have this really thriving arts and culture scene. Because they don't really care if they're very good or not. They just kind of have a crack at it. And he goes to Thailand where, you know, there's kind of fun and humor in a whole lot of things. Democracy and trust in Switzerland. And he also goes to Moldova, which is apparently one of the least happy places in the world. So it's a wonderful read. I would definitely recommend that because it's about place, and he does talk about kind of cities and like physical places a little bit as well, but it's also about kind of all the things that sit around that and how that impacts our happiness, basically. So that's something that I've really enjoyed, and I think your listeners might enjoy too.
Good recommendation. And Jess, your podcast extra?
Mine is actually the movie Oppenheimer. For those that haven't seen it, it's about the development and design of the atomic bomb. So it was a really, really interesting movie. I hadn't really, watched or read much about the history of that, and yeah, really thoroughly enjoyed it. It's about a 3-hour watch, so it's quite a lengthy movie, but really, really well worth watching. What about you, Pete?
I've got two, Jess. One is something on Netflix called Dragon Sakura, which is about a teacher trying to get a number of students in a pretty lousy high school in Japan into the University of Tokyo, which is the highest university in Japan. And it's a very prestigious place. And one of the things I'm excited about, Jess, is I'm going to Japan soon, and I'll be actually going to University of Tokyo to see Professor Kimihiro Hino, who we hope to interview on Planning Exchange, all about Japanese issues. So Dragon Sakura, it's about a 10-part series. It's very Japanese. It's a bit corny. It does get emotional, but I like that. Just following these kids and how they train to sit the entrance exam, it's very interesting. And the other thing, Jess, I've just got these, I've been starting to listen to this band called Modern Talking. They were a German band in the 90s, not techno, Jess, but 80s and 90s. And they've got a great song, Who Is Going to Save the World? And I'll put a link to a YouTube film clip that was that was made in Afghanistan about that. So,
do you want to sing it?
No, I.
You've got a wonderful voice, Pete.
I might do it next time, Jess. But if you have a look at it, maybe we can sing together. So,
oh, that just sounds delightful. I'm sure our listeners would love that.
So you've got a sweet voice, Jess. I've got a droney voice. But Liz, thanks so much for a very interesting discussion about coaching and just improving the lot of a lot of people and taking the time to develop people's skills and abilities and, I suppose, ultimately happiness. Liz, do you think there's part of that as well?
Absolutely. I think, how happy we are depends on a whole bunch of things, but I think, how fulfilled we are in the work context can definitely be part of that. So it's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed this conversation a lot. So thank you both very much for having me on.
And we're really excited for your course. I think that will be an excellent resource for planners in the industry and planners across Australia, because this is going to be a national program too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, we're going to roll it out nationally. So there'll be an info session in April, I think the 23rd of April. Anyway, yeah, check out the PIA website. It'll be on there.
Excellent. Thanks, Liz. Thanks, Pete.
Thanks so much. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you would like to hear more of our podcasts, hit the follow button on Spotify or the like button on SoundCloud or the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts. Please also visit our Instagram page, LinkedIn, or website for behind-the-scenes footage of our podcasts and to get the latest on upcoming or recently released episodes. If you have any suggestions or feedback, please get in touch via our social media channels or by emailing planningexchange@gmail.com. A special shout out also to Jack Babbage, who does such an incredible job in producing this podcast.